Richard Russell was born and raised in Eau Claire, but moved to Madison after college to work for the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Now retired, he does volunteer database development for about a dozen local nonprofit organizations. His volunteer work extends to being a tutor with the Literacy Network and a 32-gallon blood donor at the Red Cross. He calls himself a full-time media consumer and a part-time content provider. He says he has more opinions than any 10 people should be legally allowed to have, but he's trying to fix that by giving them away as fast as possible. He's the internet coordinator for Atheists and Agnostics of Wisconsin, email listserv, and the parliamentarian for Atheist Alliance International. In addition to atheism, he's also enthusiastic about science fiction, ballroom dancing, politics, social justice, the metric system, movies, Macintosh computers, Dungeons and Dragons, and the Green Bay Packers.
Keeps his, pretty busy, actually.
His fondest desire in life is to be able to clone himself so he can catch up on his reading. Richard, thanks for coming.
Thanks. Well, I always believe in handouts, and I made a bunch, so I'm going to send them around. There's four of them, cleverly color-coded, so that we can refer to them by color. So, to give you a quick synopsis of the handouts I've just distributed, the blue one called How We Decide is going to be the primary sheet I'm going to be working off of today, because we're going to talk about different decision-making processes. The orange one is something I just sort of slapped together the other day because I saw this cartoon, this comic strip, which came out earlier this week, and it sort of tickled my fancy, and I thought, you know, I should probably say something about the various chemicals in the brain that influence decision-making processes. So I just sort of threw this together as a supplement to identify the wide variety of different chemical substances that affect our brain and cause us to think we're making the right decision, regardless of whether it's what a rational person would think of. The discussion that we're going to be having today is based on a panel, science fiction convention panel that I put together for several different science fiction conventions in the Madison area called Know What, and talk about recent findings in brain research and neuropsychology. And those, of course, were panel discussions, which meant that there were two, three, four other people on the panel, not just me. And I discovered that I had way more things to say than I could say in only one-fifth of the time allocated, so I'm really grateful for today's opportunity. And lastly, we have the green sheet, which is Carl Sagan's Baloney Detection Kit, supplemented at the bottom by Michael Shermer's list of interesting questions you should ask if you're trying to detect baloney in its most commonly presented forms. So, as I said, we're going to be spending most of the time talking about how we decide. And what we see here is sort of the extract or boiled down residue left over after I read tons of books on the subject, and I've brought a bunch of them with me here today so that we can refer to them. They're also alluded to on the pink sheet as part of the bibliography at the top, but let me just hold them up and wave them at you, and you can come up and look at them afterwards if you're interested, and I could possibly be talked into lending them out. Why We Believe What We Believe, Uncovering Our Biological Need for Meaning, Spirituality, and Truth by Andrew Newberg. How We Believe by Michael Shermer, who is probably best known as the editor of Skeptic Magazine, founder of the Skeptic Society, and you'll see his name pop up in a variety of these different materials here. This one is Why People Believe Weird Things by Michael Shermer. This one I find really fascinating, Daniel Gardner's The Science of Fear, in which he talks about fear as a motivator for human behavior and human decision-making. And one of the primary theses he has here is that people are terrible at risk assessment. And we'll get into some of what he has to say on that subject a little later. Tucked into the cover of this book, or on the inside cover, is a photocopy I made from an issue of Time magazine from December 2006, which talks about what it is that could possibly kill you. And you would not believe how badly people assess the ability of various different things to do them serious damage. For example, a lot of people are just terrified of sharks. believe me, sharks have much more to worry about from human beings than we ever have to worry about from them. But you'd never guess it to watch, you know, Shark Week on the Discovery Channel. And, you know, the possibility of being killed in a terrorist attack, people who lived in host trailers in the middle of Kansas were more worried about dying from terrorist attacks than from tornadoes. We're really rotten at risk assessment, and Daniel Gardner makes that point in very dramatic fashion in The Science of Fear. How we decide, which, interestingly enough, is the, you know, the very same title I had independently arrived at before I ever encountered this book, and I saw this book, I said, hey, I wonder if this guy has some of the same things to say that I did, and largely, yes, he does. He, of course, has many more footnotes. Jonah Lehrer. And then, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Skeptical Inquirer magazine, a terrific magazine, and I can't recommend it highly enough. There are an issue that they published earlier this year, the March-April issue, Science and Anti-Science in America, Why It Matters, Open-Mindedness, What It Requires, and so on. Some of the things that they have to say there are excerpted in this pink sheet, particularly the part about open-mindedness. So these are some of the resources that I'm drawing on for what we're going to talk about today. And I'd like to open with, actually I guess I've already opened, I'd like to continue with a little scientific demonstration. Ah, small things fall faster than big things. How many people here believe that? Anybody? None of you believe that?
Depends on the air.
Well, actually hardly anybody ever believed that. Despite the evidence that you just saw before your very eyes that a small thing fell faster than a big thing, most people said, no, that's entirely wrong. What it really is, there's this little sort of balled up piece of Kleenex, which is about the same size here. What it really is, heavy things fall faster than light things. That's what it really is, right? Well, a fellow by the name of Aristotle, who is a philosopher, not a scientist. Aristotle lived about, I have these dates only approximately right, approximately 380, 320 years before the Common Era, and was an inordinately smart dude. Spent a lot of time thinking about how the world worked and trying to organize knowledge in a meaningful fashion, seeing how things related to each other. But he was a philosopher. He was not a scientist. He certainly was not an experimentalist. He took what most people understood about the world and tried to formulate it in meaningful fashions. And he was the person who said, you know, based on what everybody knew, heavy things fall faster than light things. And people believed him, you know, because why not? I mean, Aristotle said it. You know, he's a pretty smart guy, right? He knows all this other stuff. And it didn't overtly contradict your daily experience. And so why not believe him? It seemed perfectly reasonable. And this state of affairs persisted for 2,000 years. Until we had Galileo, who in 1638 said, you know, something not quite right about that. Now, he wasn't the first person who came up with the idea that Aristotle's take on falling objects seemed a little shaky. But he was the one who popularized the idea that, that Aristotle was wrong. He was also the person that came up with the idea of testing experimentally to find out how it really worked. And once he found out how it really worked, he was the person who converted the observations into a mathematical formula that accurately described falling objects, which, as we have now discovered, big one, little one, land at the same time. So, how many people in this room, before this very moment, believed that heavy objects fall as fast as light objects? How many people believed that prior to today? Not that many. Really? All right, let's ask some of you who didn't hold your hands up, what did you think about the difference between light objects and heavy objects? Anybody who didn't?
I didn't think about it at all.
Didn't think about it at all? Which, you know, really, that's a very good answer. Anybody else have comments about what did you think prior to today about light objects versus heavy objects? Several of you did not hold up your hands. It's probably because you were shy. Okay.
I believe that it was a balance of forces, so that air resistance slows down a light object if it's large enough.
Okay, so if you were to take away the external considerations, would light objects fall as fast as heavy objects?
In a vacuum.
Yes, you think so. Let's test again. How many people prior to this, you know, seeing these things fall, thought that light objects fell as fast as heavy objects in a vacuum? Ah, okay, more people. Of those of you who thought that, how many of you actually saw the experiment done or did it yourself prior to today? Anybody? A couple people actually saw it done. Of those of you who actually saw it done, did any of you actually see it done with the vacuum tube with a feather? Yes, a couple people did. Now, all the rest of you, now, who held up your hand saying you believe that light objects fall as fast as heavy objects in a vacuum, are taking somebody else's word for it. You didn't actually perform the experiment yourself. And that's how most people learn most stuff, is they take somebody else's word for it. It isn't, and you know, that is, in many respects, the great glory of the human race, is we are able to pass information on from the older generation, which presumably has learned how things work, to the younger generation. So the younger generation doesn't have to go out there and try it for themselves, which of course hasn't stopped them from going out there and trying things for themselves anyway. But it's our great advantage as a species over the other animals that have to go out and learn things by experience. We can pass along the information without having to run people through the experience. But that gets us to the drawback to this method of communicating information, which is that it's perfectly possible to pass along bad information, just as Aristotle did for 2,000 years. And people trusted Aristotle because he was right about so many other things. I mean, he really was a very smart dude, and he really could express himself very well, and he was right about a whole lot of things. And so there's this halo effect saying, well, if Aristotle said it, it must be true. And therefore, people believed what he had to say because he was an authority, because they trusted him, because he was good at a lot of things. And so there's all the stuff he was right about, and there's this one thing he was wrong about, but the one thing he was wrong about went along for the ride because it was from Aristotle. Same thing happens when little kids learn stuff from their parents. They learn the bad stuff right along with the good stuff. And that's generally to the best, because the way you learn things when you're a kid is to trust the authority figures. If mom says, don't go down by the river, you know, and we have a spectrum here with curiosity on one side and obedience on the other side, each of these has its advantages. If mom says don't go down by the river, and you're an obedient little kid, you don't go down by the river, you know, you're probably okay. You're a curious kid, you go down by the river, the croc gets you. Which is why mom told you not to go down by the river in the first place. Now it may be that mom never even saw a crocodile, but grandma did, and she told mom don't go down by the river, and mom told you don't go down by the river. Not based on what you would call a reason, not based on an accurate risk assessment, based on the propagation of knowledge down through the generations. Both obedience and curiosity have survival value. Obedience means that you've learned the lessons, or you've picked up or assimilated the lessons that your parents or forebears have already learned. Curiosity enables you to discover new knowledge that you can pass on to succeeding generations, which is why the two of these things are always in tension with each other, and why, as survival characteristics go, neither one of them has triumphed over the other. Both have their advantages in a society that communicates information from older generations to younger generations. Both of them have virtue and value when it comes to making decisions. Which brings us to the subject that we are going to talk about today, which is different decision-making techniques. I'd like to talk about the idea factory, which starts with inputs, goes through processes, and arrives at outputs. I hope this looks familiar to you because it appears right near the top of the blue sheet. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on inputs and outputs. We'll just talk about what the inputs and outputs are. The outputs are The results of decision-making are the things we do, say, think, and believe. They also include several things which occur below or perhaps outside the level of conscious thought, such as emotions, aesthetics, and habits. Generally, the things that occur outside conscious thought, I'm going to skip over altogether because I'm mainly interested in how we make conscious decisions. Those are the outputs, things we believe, say, think, do. The inputs, each of the inputs has its own problems, but these are what go into the decision-making process. Definitions, axioms, ordinary assumptions, genetics, sensations, that is, sensation, eye, hearing, sight, taste, etc. Memories, which are fossilized sensations, and testimony, which is other people's sensations. Those are all inputs into the decision-making process. Every single one of them fallible. Every single one of them can be wrong. And we could go through a whole flock of optical illusions and easily made mistakes that people make all the time based on what they have coming in. We can talk about the false assumptions, such as the one that Aristotle was right, all of which can lead to bad decisions. But every one of the decision-making processes has that same problem with the inputs. The inputs could be bad for any one of the processes. And so that is not something which serves to distinguish between the processes. What we're looking for is what processes produce the best outputs, given the fact that the inputs are shaky or can be shaky to begin with. And we will talk about 8 different processes, that's just this central column here, 8 different processes for arriving at decisions. They are logic, reason, confidence, trust, chance, obedience, hope, and faith. Chance, obedience, hope, and faith. And I have these ranked in order from top to bottom, from most reliable to least reliable. And the title of today's presentation, as announced, was From Logic to Faith. I hope you don't think that that was the progression I intended to recommend.
Logic is the input and faith is the output.
Actually, it is my contention, and I'll just cut to the bottom line on this, is my contention that faith is listed as a decision-making process only in a sort of honorary fashion, since the stuff that you get out of it is largely indistinguishable from the stuff you put into it in the first place. It's sort of like cream corn through the digestive system. It doesn't improve upon it at all. Perhaps it may reformulate it in some fashion, but really you're getting out the same thing you put in. It's really not a process at all. Logic is the most reliable, and it's also the place where it's easiest to see how you can be led astray by bad inputs. The example I do not give you here is the 3-step process called a syllogism. Syllogism starts with 2 premises, all triangles are brown. That's premise number 1. Premise number 2, this square is a triangle. Conclusion, this square is brown. Logically speaking, perfectly valid, 100% valid reasoning. You talk about a characteristic that all members of this class have, all triangles, anything that can be classified as a triangle has this property. You say that this particular object is a member of this class, therefore this particular object has this property, absolutely unassailable from a logical standpoint. Dead wrong, but the process is rock solid. If you start with true premises, you will arrive at a true conclusion. If you start with false premises, you may or may not arrive at a true conclusion, but at least you'll know how you got there. If you start with true premises, you do arrive at a true conclusion. That's the beauty of this thing. And so, as a decision-making process, logic is, the bee's knees. Reason is very similar to logic, but you usually throw in considerations like, I've only got just so much time to spend on this thing. What would a reasonable person believe? And, this is not a bad standard. It's a standard we use in the law. If you say, okay, I walk in, there's a dead body on the floor, you're standing there holding a smoky gun and say, gotcha, you son of a bitch. A reasonable person would conclude you're the person that shot the victim. It's not necessarily true, but it's a perfectly reasonable thing to believe. And there's a lot of other things that are like that. There's a reason why that's a legal standard. It's because it turns out in most social interactions, that particular technique will provide you with the best results without being exhaustive and fanatic about it. Next one down the line is confidence. And I distinguish between confidence and trust because the way the language has evolved, so we usually place confidence in things and trust in people. They're very similar to each other, except for that semantic difference, and except for the fact that as social beings, we are more inclined to be trusting of people that we shouldn't be trusting of than we are to be confident in things that we shouldn't be confident of. Illustration. Last winter, my car started when it was 10 below. I therefore believe that my car will probably start this winter when it's 10 below. That's confidence. You know, you say, all right, I've got a track record to go on. I have, you know, there's some reason to think that that's the case because I have prior experience with it. You can extend that and say, well, you know, I'm reasonably confident my car will start when it's 20 below. I'm pretty confident my car will start when it's 30 below. Well, eventually you get to the point where you're passing on down from confidence into hope, okay? You're drawing inferences that may not be justified by on the basis of your experience, but it's not a bad thing to say, you know, I've been down this road before, I've seen how it works out, I have confidence that it will continue to work that way. You place trust in people. Because we are social beings, we are inclined to be nice to other people and give them the benefit of the doubt. Kids notoriously trust their parents, whether they should or not. Parents will sometimes just do awful things to the kids. The kids love them anyway because they're their parents. You know, the folks that are known as confidence agents, you know, they use the word confidence. Really, what they're doing is they're eliciting trust from people because you say, would I lie to you? Yeah, probably. You know, anybody asks that question. Or if you run into somebody who says, trust me, don't trust them. Okay, because what they're doing is they're preying on your natural tendency to want to get along with other people. We are an immensely social species. We have to be. Because, you know, if we weren't an immensely social species, we are your basic prey animals. We have no fangs. We have no claws. You know, we have no body armor. We don't have fur. We're not very fast. We're plump and tasty. You know, we're just really obviously prey animals, and so if we didn't get along with each other well enough to form cooperative groups to fend off the predators, we would be eaten. And so we are social, and we have to be social to raise the little helpless things. The reason we have the little helpless things is because, and the reason they're helpless for so long, is because our survival advantage hinges on our big brains. The brains are what distinguish human beings from the other critters, and it's what gives us our advantage when it comes to long-term survival. But we pay a price for that. In fact, it's a price that's mentioned somewhere in the first couple of verses of the Bible, when God kicks Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden, says, "And you, woman, you know, for all your faults, you and all your descendants will suffer pain in childbirth from here on out." Well, that was something that they noticed early enough that they put it right at the top of the Bible, because other animals don't have that problem. Then the reason for that is because they're not trying to give birth to creatures with giant skulls that have to hold these big honking brains. The human species would probably have gone extinct if we hadn't developed a sort of trick, which is that the brain keeps on growing after you're born. It doesn't come out largely developed the same way as it does, and you've probably seen pictures of a colt or a calf or a fawn shortly after birth, struggling to its feet, trying to nurse from its mom. Human infants do not struggle to their feet for another year. They're helpless. And if we weren't an immensely social species, they would die. In fact, probably if you go back in our distant ancestry, those who might have been our ancestors who let the little ones die turned out not to be our ancestors because they didn't leave descendants. The ones that succeeded were the ones that were tender and nurturing and took care of the little ones, which is why we look at those little critters with big gooey eyes, and even though by all rights we should kill them, we can't because we're hardwired to be very fond of them. So and it's reciprocal. We are very fond of the little babies, the little infants. We take very good care of them. They, in turn, repose their trust in us, and they take our word for it when we say, this is the way you should behave, this is what you should believe. So trust is something that doesn't generally have to be earned. It's generally just taken for granted. And consequently, if the parents, you know, are stupid or abusive or believe bad things, you trust them anyway. And so this is not as reliable a method of decision-making as confidence, where you don't have that emotional attachment to your car. Or maybe you do, but not as much as to your parents in all likelihood. Now this chance here is a decision-making technique, and it strikes a lot of people as odd. Says, well, how do you, you know, why would you think of that as a decision-making technique? So, well, getting set to buy a new bicycle, could be either the red one or the blue one. I don't really know which. It's going to be the blue one. All right, you've made a decision. And the reason you're able to use chance to make the decision is because the two alternatives are roughly equal in your mind. You've thought through as much as you feel like thinking through about them. And at this point, you're better served just by having a decision of any sort. And so chance is as good a method as any of making a decision. Obedience is like trust, except that it's sort of a corrupted version of it. It means that you're making the decision based on what somebody else is telling you to do, and it may not necessarily be a decision that you would make left to your own devices. It may not necessarily be a decision made in your own best interest, but somebody's telling you got to do it, and if you don't do it, you have other adverse consequences that you want to avoid. And so this is not necessarily a way of making decisions that are good for you, but it's a way of getting a decision made, which may lead to your safety. Hope, well, we're getting pretty tenuous when it comes to decision-making processes here. Say, well, golly, I really want to go to my sister's wedding in Milwaukee, but the car has just been going cough, 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 cough. Can I make it all the way to Milwaukee? God, I've got it. You know, I just got to be there for my sister's wedding. So here we go. Just get in the car and set on out. You're making a decision based on hope. You hope you can make it because there's something you really want to do. And even though logic and reason and experience and all the other things are telling you, it's pretty shaky, you do it because there's a very desirable outcome. And lastly, we come to faith, which is like hope in many respects, except that it's got a lot more negatives going for it. You only haul out faith when there's absolutely no reason whatsoever to believe in something. In fact, there's a lot of reasons not to believe in it. But for whatever reason, psychological reasons, emotional reasons, desire to impress somebody, social pressures, so on, you say, okay, well, I will believe this. Despite the fact that there's no good reason for it, I take it on faith. Faith is an absolutely terrible method of decision making. But since it's the one that keeps the paychecks rolling into the priest class, it's the one that they are fondest of. In fact, they try their very best to conflate it with other things that are more worthy of your admiration. You say, well, don't you have faith in the government? That's probably not a good example. Let's try another one. Don't you have faith in your parents? Don't you have faith in the goodwill of your company? Don't you have faith in the ability of the Packers to win the game tomorrow night? All those are attempts to apply the label faith to a decision-making process which really is one of these other ones that is more worthy of your respect. And by doing this, by conflating the term faith with other things, they're trying to get you to buy into the idea that faith is a good thing. Faith is a terrible thing. You should stay away from it at all costs because it invariably leads you down the wrong road. And, you know, I say this to a lot of people and they're just startled because so much has been invested in the idea that faith is a good thing. And you keep hearing over and over again, have faith, keep the faith, baby. You know, Lutherans name their churches after it. Devout parents name their girl children after it. Faith, you know, it's a wonderful thing. But it isn't. It sucks. It's terrible. It's the world's worst decision-making technique. And I can't stress this often enough because there's so much false admiration or false respect built up for the concept of faith as a decision-making method that there's this tremendous amount of inertia we have to overcome. So that's my basic song and dance about how we decide. I'm going to just briefly talk about some of the things that stand in the way of being able to make decisions on a rational basis, and then we'll open up for widespread discussion. I'm sure that you folks have things to say. Some of the things that stand in the way of being able to arrive at reasonable or rational decisions are listed over here under common biases. And I'm not going to go into each of these individually. It would take us, you know, we could turn this into a semester-long course with 31 installments if we wanted. Other than to say that there's all sorts of reasons why you might be misled if you're trying to engage in a decision-making process, why you would be misled into making bad decisions because of innate built-in human biases. And we all have them, whether we recognize them or not. In fact, the reason that they're called biases is because we typically don't recognize the ones we have. It's just there as part of our background, and it's very difficult to detect this in yourself. Easier to detect it in others, of course, especially others that you disagree with, but hard to detect in yourself. I drew this list of biases from a variety of different sources, and I added one at the bottom after having made this list. And as I said, I got this from a variety of different places and said, you know, putting these together in the form of a list probably makes me sound like some sort of authority. So I'm going to put one more at the bottom, list bias, as people tend to be biased in favor of anyone who can put together a list. Because they say, wow, if he knows all those things, he must be really smart or at least really knowledgeable or at least capable of counting to 31. And so they tend to be biased in favor of people who can put together lists. There's one other aspect to list bias, which is the halo effect. It might be that there's something in here that's completely dead wrong, because like Aristotle's comment about falling bodies, it's buried in among a bunch of other things that are believable. You say, well, that's probably just as believable as all the others, when in fact, each one of these things probably should be evaluated independently as to whether it's true or not. So that's list bias, and it's one that, as far as I can tell, I've discovered myself, or at least have been the first to add to a list. The requirements for open-mindedness, and this is the second half of the title Skeptical Inquirer, and they spend a lot of time about being skeptical, but every now and again they say, well, but really this is all an aspect of inquiry generally, and we do want to know things, we don't want to find things out, we do want to pass along information, and so inquiry is a basic part of that process, and if we want to inquire about things, we have to be open to a wide variety of possibilities. There are drawbacks to being completely open-minded. You know, as it says there, there's a difference between being open-minded and having holes in your head. But open-mindedness is generally a good thing, and if you're trying to be open-minded, you should take into account these various factors. Many people will try to hornswoggle you because they'll take advantage of the way your decision-making process works. Carl Sagan has warned us about a variety of these. Michael Shermer has warned us about some more. I'm not going to take a lot of time to go into this. One of the findings in neuroscience is that while we may think we're making a rational decision, in fact, it's probably the subconscious that made the decision, handed it up to the conscious mind, said, here's your decision. The conscious mind said, oh, this is what I'm going to decide to do. Turns out that conscious thought is not nearly as important as we thought, or as we have been led to believe when it comes to making decisions. Whole lots of things go on below the level of conscious thought. In fact, the conscious brain, which as far as we can tell is something that exists uniquely among human beings and no other species, the conscious brain is a really recent addition, and some people contend it only goes back, maybe a few tens of thousands of years, and it isn't very well developed at this point. So what you get as a conscious decision, or what you think is a conscious decision, was probably made by some lower primate level of your brain, probably influenced unduly by one or more of the chemicals I've identified here, but you think it's rational because you're engaging in a process called, not surprisingly, rationalization. And you can take decisions that were made for emotional reasons or, just happened to be the way the domino toppled in your brain or influenced by other people, whatever, and you can find all sorts of reasons to believe in them after the decision has already been made. And this is called confirmation bias, as you tend to find reasons to believe things that you've already decided upon, even if you haven't decided upon them rationally. Tons of experimental evidence to this effect. Okay, I've rattled on long enough. Time for you guys to chip in.
I had made a little check mark next to confirmation bias, which you just defined. What is perseverance bias?
What is perseverance bias? Let me see it in context here.
It's in between perceptual. 19. It's number 19 on your playlist.
Perseverance bias. What is that? Let me think about it a little bit.
Maybe it's that you can't give up an opinion because you've been emotionally invested.
Yes, that is what it is. It's things where
often guilty.
The verb is perseveration.
Yeah, it's things where you've tended down a particular road and there's a bias toward continuing down that road. You want to persevere just because, well, why? Just because. Nobody's really quite sure. It's a bias. Mm-hmm. If there was an underlying explanation for it, we could probably eliminate the bias. But it's a tendency among human beings because it's been rewarded in the past by various social stimuli. And so it's sort of built into the way we try to make decisions. There's a bunch of other ones in here which are not things you would have expected right off the top of your head. Like number 12 here, magic number bias.
Oh, yeah.
It turns out that if you are exposed to a number of any sort in any context at all, having nothing whatever to do with the decision you're getting set to make, like for example, you said, temperature outside about 30 today. The number 30 gets into your brain and is out there circulating around and has a mathematically, experimentally demonstrable influence on any decision you make in about the next half hour to hour that involves numbers. Why should this be the case? Because it's accessible, because it's a number that's somewhere in the forefront of your brain, and it tends to be the sort of thing that influences your decision-making process because it's close to the conscious decision-making part of your mind at that moment. And so once the number is introduced into your consciousness, and it can be in an entirely different, irrelevant context from whatever you're getting set to make the decision about, it influences that decision. And there's a ton of experimental evidence to show this.
I've got a thought that may fit into this list. I'm not sure if it's included in one of your numbered items, which is my understanding is that psychologists tell us that if you repeat something, make a statement over and over again, you tend to believe what you say.
Absolutely.
Is that on this list?
I think that's a form of confirmation bias.
Okay.
Interestingly, attractiveness bias, the one immediately above it, mm-hmm. is, you might think, well, that can't really mean that you're fonder of pretty people than ugly people. Yes, that's exactly what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And funny people are more interesting than dull people. And anybody who's ever attended a college class knows that people who speak in animated voices are more interesting than people who speak in a slow monotone.
Mathematicians like beautiful formulas.
It's what?
Mathematicians like beautiful formulas.
They do. In fact, there's an old joke among scientists that there's no tragedy so great as a beautiful theory destroyed by an ugly fact.
And I worked in control rooms, especially in nuclear power plants, and I remember the one I put on, we had a phone, of course, a machine shop, electrical, and somebody stuck dial prayer on there. Dial prayer. So if things really got bad, you can push that. But the point I wanted to make was that experience really has a tremendous influence. If we could take, say, four or five of us and give us all the same training, and then something, for instance, in a control, an alarm comes in, well, how we react to that alarm has all to do with our experience before, what has happened to us. And we may be, no matter, the training may be identical, but our response will be completely different just because of our background.
And actually, when you say that the training is partially influences what you do, the thing that has more influence than anything else is the subconscious stuff that you've picked up quite independent of the training. On the other hand, you know, if we were to take that to an unreasonable extreme, we'd say, well, then what's the point of training at all? It turns out that training, and especially training that involves repetition and practice, really are very good at getting you to be able to do the right thing in a crisis, as we saw when Captain Sullenberger landed the plane on the Hudson River earlier this year. He knew exactly what to do because he'd been through the scenarios multiple times. And, you know, as a person who spent his entire career in education, far be it from me to say that education is worthless. You know, education does a tremendous amount of good in society, including helping to overcome some of the stupid things that we learned from our parents. Yes.
I was just going to say, like, in the last week, we've had the incident at the White House where the people got through. And I think that was because the perception was that they looked like they belonged there. Mm-hmm. They were good looking. And then there was another one recently where a prisoner just escaped because he was in a wheelchair and the guards didn't search him because they felt sorry for him and he had a gun.
Yep.
Still got him. He's on the loose now. The one thing I want to bring up is intuition. And I don't know where intuition goes in here, and maybe women have this more. There's been whole Oprah shows on intuition. Intuition of, it's the fear, and how if you feel fear, there's a reason why you're feeling that way, and you should react accordingly to that. And I don't know if that fits in your decision process, where it's just something you know. You either observe something, and usually it's in context with another person. These people, in many cases, were able to avoid a mass murderer or something because it didn't feel right to them.
Actually, the second book on the bibliography on this pink sheet here is called Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. Mm-hmm. And that talks about the ability to make snap decisions in a limited amount of time. Turns out that people who are really good at doing that are folks who we generally identify as experts. And a couple of examples they cite, and I think Why We Believe What We Believe is one of the other places where you can find that, or maybe it's How We Decide, I can't remember. These things have all sort of run together in my head. Examples of that are an art critic who looks at a painting and can tell you that's a fake, or that's authentic. And then you say, well, how do you know? And they have to stop and think about it, but they can tell you because they've had a lot of experience looking at works that were done by the purported artist and say, there's just something wrong about that, and they may be hard-pressed to figure out why. If they spend a long time thinking about it, they can come up with it. You get another illustration that's used in one of these books is a football quarterback dropping back to pass, and you've got like 3 seconds to decide what you're going to do because there's very large people coming to smash you flat. This is not a time to engage in a rational cost-benefit analysis. You have to come up with a snappy decision or be crushed. Quarterbacks who are good at this are not necessarily the smartest people. They're not necessarily the ones that you would hire as a teacher or as an engineer or as an architect. But they're good at that particular thing because of all the practice they've had. And so intuition is that sort of thing. It's based on your life experience, and you have sort of a feeling for how this should work. And that intuitive sense is not coming from the conscious part of your brain. It's welling up from something deeper inside that's based on your experience that goes back to, we've had life forms on this planet for about 3.5 billion years, and multicellular life for, I think, 1.5 billion, and we've had a conscious, we as human beings have existed as a species for 1 to 2 million years, and we've had a conscious mind for something in the order of maybe 100,000 years. Vast, vast majority of the wiring in our brain is attributable to all those experiences we had before we evolved rational thought, before we became a separate species. And those are still the things that influence our decisions much more than anything else. Whether we know it or not, whether we feel like admitting it or not, we're sort of conceited about our wonderful cerebral cortex, which does all this great rational processing. But it turns out that it's really not responsible for all those decisions at all.
The reptilian brain?
A lot of certainly the fight or flight response, right straight out of the reptilian brain.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings up a topic of phobias, because I've always thought phobias were actually survival techniques. If you're afraid of heights, well, chances are you didn't go climb up on a mountain and fall down and be killed, so your genetic traits were passed along.
It turns out that while a lot of other animals are driven by instinct, human beings have only 3 innate instincts. One is fear of loud noises, 2 is fear of falling, and 3rd is we're attracted to smiles. Smile is universal. So 2 of those are phobias, and 1 of them is an attractor.
What's the first one again?
Fear of loud noises. There's also a substantial fear of snakes, which is also alluded to in the Bible. It's one of the reasons why the serpent was condemned to crawl on his belly, is because, biblical people were worried about snakes. It isn't there's disparate opinions whether that actually is down at the instinctual level or is just a very common phobia. But a lot of experiments indicate that those are the only three things that are universal to human beings, but there's just a flock of different phobias that people are afraid of for whatever reason. And nobody really knows where all the phobias come from, because it's very difficult to trace our experience back. Like, why are you afraid of spiders if you've never seen a spider before? Well, some people are. We don't know why.
Number 13.
Right.
In your discussion of the unconscious, are you implying that those are biological processes? In your discussion of the unconscious, what it is, are you implying that it's biological processes that determine behavior?
I'm sorry if I only implied it. I should have stated it categorically. Yes, it is only biological processes. But it's based on the inputs, which come from a wide variety of environmental sources. And so
environmental sources can change your biology?
Absolutely. 100%, you bet they can.
Either influence or change.
Yeah, the reason your brain contains what it does today, contains the synaptic connections it does. And incidentally, you have just an unbelievably large number of synaptic connections in your brain. The reason the ones that you have are there is because of external influences, for the most part. They're determined to some extent by the genetic heritage you've got, and they're determined to some extent by the chemical bath that you're bathed in during your state as an embryo. But most of the neurons you have are in place at the time you're born, and then they start dying off based on your experience. And the ones that survive are the ones that turned out to be useful to you for whatever reason, because they got a lot of reinforcement. But you bet your experience has a tremendous influence on the way your brain develops. Which, partly explains why so many religious people seem to be largely immune to appeals to rationality, is because the way their brains evolved, they were much more interested, they were much more heavily rewarded for some of these other decision-making processes than they were for rationality. And so they tend to be more willing to engage in faith or in confidence or in trust than they are in reason. Reason really is not that common a phenomenon in human beings. And we should not have expected it to be, because it's really pretty recent. It's been grafted on top of all these millennia or thousands and thousands of years of irrational decision-making processes.
Yeah, well, Gladwell's blink hypothesis is a little bit oversimplistic. I don't know which bias you'd call it, perhaps the expectancy. If, as a physician, say you have recently seen a case of such and such, then that's going to be at the top of your mind, and you're not going to make a rational decision about the next person who walks into your office, because that expectancy is, well, it must be H1N1 because we're having a lot of that now. And that's not based, and you might make what seems to be a blink decision. After all, you're an expert, you're the doctor. But blink isn't always reliable, in other words. And the same, some of the people who said those artworks were genuine were highly expert, but they must have had some expectancy or experience prior to that that made them, or maybe it was something about the reputation of the, it was the Getty Museum, I think, they wouldn't have.
Well, Gladwell, of course, is trying to sell books. So he oversells his theory, but I don't fault him very much for that, because what he's doing is trying to provide a corrective for what seems to be far and away a more common opinion in the opposite direction, which turns out to be wrong more often than we normally think. So his sense, Gladwell's sense, that snap decision making by people who are qualified to make it is something we should pay more attention to, deserves some attention. Now, does it deserve all the attention he thinks it does? Probably not. But it deserves more than it got prior to his book.
The people who make those decisions should also be very well aware that they could be wrong.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, absolutely. as should we all. As I said right at the beginning here, all the inputs, these are various different processes, and they can take the inputs you get and with progressively less and less degree of reliability give you reliable outputs. But every one of them relies on inputs, and every one of the inputs is fallible. Every one of the inputs has got its own problems.
I like that syllogism, because the first item there is all triangles are round, is a kind of definition, right? And so I've been interested, well, obviously all of us who think very much are very interested in how we define the words we use. And we define them in all kinds of different ways, which often lead to false conclusions.
Yeah, that's why one of the things I...
With a basically faulty definition.
That's why one of the things I list here, the very first item I list under inputs in this blue sheet, incidentally, is in fact definitions. Because if you start off in a conversation with somebody and you're both using a term, but it means two different things, you know, this is going to lead to problems with your conversation. It will certainly lead to problems with your conclusion. So, to some extent, you have to start out by defining your terms. And that's easier if you're speaking the same actual language, like English, or as opposed to Spanish or something, as other people. But even if you do speak the same language, there's a lot of terms in our own language that are a little on the fuzzy side. Some people take them one way, some people take them another. And that can lead to confusion and in many cases, conflict, misunderstanding, bad feelings, and so on.
I think that's an enormous problem. There's a whole set of semantics.
Well, there's an up and a down to it. The fact is that we have more concepts in the English language than we have words, and that's the problematic part. The upside is that there are more words in the English language than there are in any others, and so we've been able to do a better job of sorting things out than most other languages have. But, you know, I'm just trying to make the case here that priests and ministers and rabbis have to spend a lot of time touting faith as a decision-making process because it's where their money comes from. You know, quite independently of getting you to try to buy their conclusions, they're trying to get you to buy into the decision-making process by which you arrive at those conclusions. You know, sort of taking the level of disbelief a step farther up the line. And so instead of talking about outcomes, they talk about processes. And in order to give faith a greater luster in the mind of their congregations, they try to conflate it with these other things that, you know, really are more reliable decision-making techniques. And so the definition of faith to a minister has many more meanings to it than the meaning that I'm assigning to it here, where I'm trying to make clear-cut distinctions between these various things. But in fact, if you were to look at a dictionary, they would list several of these other things as synonyms for faith, which is why it's important to determine if you are engaging in a discussion like this, that I'm referring to faith only in an extremely narrow sense as meaning decisions that you make in the absence of evidence or in the face of evidence to the contrary. I don't mean it as being a sort of slang version of trust. And you're right, it's absolutely right to be able to have those understandings right off the bat in terms of the definitions of the terms you're using. Other comments?
I worked for Pacific Gas and Electric, and the first time they built their first nuclear power plant, they were trying to decide who they should have to operate the plant, who the best operators would be. And they found that they couldn't define that. If you could follow better, like drivers, you can't define what makes a good driver. He may be not smarter than the other guy. So what they did, they took, I think they had maybe 15 shift supervisors, and they rated them according to who was good and who wasn't. Then they gave a battery of tests. It had nothing to do with power plants. Then they gave us the same battery of tests. And then they said, the people who do well on the test the best supervisors did well on are probably going to do well without anything. And it worked out pretty well. It worked out for me. But it was good because you couldn't define it. It was too complex.
Yeah, there are times when you just have to rely on somebody's value judgment. I mean, the first time you're opening up a brand new field of study, there are no experts yet. And so people are all just start groping and feeling their way blindly around. And eventually it turns out that some people are more successful than others and they become the authority in the field. And then you go to them and find out, well, what should we do about this? That was certainly the case when AIDS first hit. We had like people saying, well, it turns out there's two major categories of people who are affected by this, gay men and Haitians.
Yeah.
You know, and the old joke was, well, the hard part about getting AIDS is going to convince your mother you're a Haitian.
Yeah.
Well, it turned out that this was a false lead. And people who said, yeah, we know that for some reason or other, there's some environmental factor in Haiti that makes them more predisposed to AIDS than elsewhere in the world. No, there wasn't. It turns out that there's a cultural bias that was really profoundly disparaging of gay people, gay men in particular, in Haiti. And so if you had AIDS, the last thing in the world you would do is ever admit that you got it through gay sex. And so, you know, it turned out to be mainly gay men, even in Haiti. And after a while, we came to realize that, and the experts, you know, shifted away from that line of thinking. But going into it, that was the best thinking. And there's all sorts of things that are going on in science now where, as far as we can tell, the best thinking in these extremely ephemeral areas, you know, is probably held by folks that have a string of letters after their name, and who are we to know any different? I mean, I don't know any different. As I said right at the very beginning, we take somebody else's word for almost everything we know. We don't go out and independently verify it because we don't have the time. And really, it would be a waste of time for almost everything. There's very few things in the world that where common knowledge is so far off base that you aren't probably okay going with it.
How about Fox News?
Fox News. You know, Fox News is telling a lot of people exactly what they want to hear, which is why their ratings are so high. And of course, there's a difference between news and common knowledge. You know, common knowledge is stuff that you've already internalized. News is stuff that you're adding to your store of common knowledge. You know, are you going to go really wrong listening to what they say? Well, you're not going to go totally far off base because they aren't going to completely come right out and lie to you. But they're going to slant it. You know, and there's a difference between lying and slanting. But bias is innately built into everything we do, and that's what makes it such a challenge. If you want to be rational, you have to try to account for the bias, and the bias that you should be trying most hard to account for is the one that's least visible to you, which is your own.
Yeah, in your list, I noticed that hope and faith, in practice, using the words a little more broadly, seem to include excluding entire bodies of information, entire sources of that. There's at least one major Catholic university whose course listing I looked at a number of years ago, and they had a religion department, and they taught the Old Testament, the New Testament, and Catholicism. Well, if you have a religion department, maybe spending at least, you know, a day on Hinduism, Mahayana Buddhism as opposed to the less religious part, you know, this sort of thing, but all this other stuff is excluded. Most of the most biased people I know derive their information from sources that exclude input. They just exclude entire bodies of input. I've got a good friend who is very much a humanist and a free thinker. But when you get him on the subject of politics, he's interested in what's written in certain publications which don't reflect more than a very narrow viewpoint. They just don't. And that's where he insists on drawing his input.
I think that's a strong temptation for a lot of us.
It's probably true of just about everybody, yeah. Frankly. I don't go out of my way to listen to Fox News.
Yeah. Doesn't that go back to the trust thing? Who do you trust?
And to a large extent, it does.
So I mean, you're still using your process to determine what information you're allowing to come into you because
you aren't going out independently verifying it. Do I know that Paris, France exists? No, it just seems to me that there's so much invested in its existence that people would have to have a gigantically vast conspiracy to convince me that it exists, even though it doesn't. And it is much more probable that it exists than that such a conspiracy exists.
I had a theory when I was growing up that Italy didn't exist. That if you got to the French border, somebody would swear you in and tell you to keep it secret. It was a very amusing thought.
It is, but you know, but it underlines the fact that most of what we know about the rest of the world, we're taking somebody else's word for it, and at least they're consistent. You know, you have to go a long ways to find somebody that says, "Well, Italy doesn't exist." Almost everybody says it does. You don't have to go quite so far to find people who say the Holocaust never happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You don't have to go very far at all to find people who say evolution is a crock. So what it comes down to in a case like that is, well, should I believe the Discovery Institute or should I believe, you know, Richard Dawkins? And you choose the place that strikes you as being most reliable. Mm-hmm. And it's my contention that if you pay careful attention to these various biases, you will find Richard Dawkins to be much more reliable than the Discovery Institute. But a lot of people don't. They just say, oh, well, you know, these are good-hearted people and they're believers in Jesus. You know, therefore they must be right. You know, would they lie to us?
I'd like to point out that there's a whole lot at stake, and we all know this, in what we're talking about here. For example, collapsed societies, Easter Island, there's one, Greenland,
yep.
The Norwegian colonies in Greenland, and those collapsed societies collapsed because the people in the societies refused or just made errors in making decisions. The kinds of errors that you're talking about here.
Yeah, and
basic Greenland, there's plenty of examples to follow. The Eskimos that also lived in Greenland survived, but the Greenlanders coming from Norway basically refused to learn from the Eskimos. They said, we're right, the Eskimos have it all wrong, and therefore we're going to die out.
Yeah, and I don't know how many of you have encountered the... I don't know how many of you encountered the recent book by Richard Dawkins entitled The Greatest Show on Earth, and he makes the case that there's absolutely no survival... Let's see if I can phrase it the way he does. He says a lot of people worry about all the pain and suffering in the world, and they say, oh, this is terrible. There should be some way of selecting against pain and suffering. That should be a goal of evolution. He says, no, it's not at all. He says, if you were a gazelle and you developed a method of injecting an anesthetic into your system as soon as the tiger sank his fangs into you so that you wouldn't feel the tiger eating your guts while you're still alive, how would you pass that on to your descendants? You wouldn't, because you're about to die. He says, so there's absolutely no evolutionary reason why we should ever have evolved characteristics that allow us to take the welfare of the entire society into account. The only creatures that do that, and he says you can see examples of this in real life. You will see predators who will completely eat all of their prey, essentially destroying their seed corn because there is no longer any prey to have offspring for the benefit of future generations of the predators. They will, in fact, completely demolish the prey in an area, following which they will all starve to death. And you'd say, well, you know, if they'd just done a better job of husbanding the resources, it would have been better for everybody. But there's no environmental or evolutionary reason for doing that, just as there's no evolutionary reason not to have pain or to mitigate pain. The only species that seems to be at all interested in doing it is the one and only species we know of that's evolved consciousness. And we do try to take a broader view of things, and we're still very bad at it because we haven't been doing it for very long. I thought I saw a hand back there.
In this conversation, made me strike a comment about judges. Everybody's saying judges need to be unbiased. That's ridiculous. We're all human beings. We all subject to all those biases. And that's always drives me crazy. You employ people who seem to be good at what they do, but you don't say, well, you're biased, therefore you're not going to be a good judge, because we're all biased. So that's always crazy about human beings to say, well...
Yes or no. I mean, if you just say, well, we're all biased and throw up your hands and say there's no chance anybody will ever be able to make a rational decision ever, then you pretty much lumped us all into the same boat as Glenn Beck and Adolf Hitler. People are capable of making decisions despite the fact that they may be biased, but trying their best to compensate for those biases. And some people are clearly more biased and more irrationally biased than others. I mean, there are sexist and racist judges. I don't know how many of you were in Madison when Archie Simonson was on the bench and, you know, came up with this unbelievably sexist statement where he let some convicted rapist off the hook because he said, oh, well, he was just doing what men normally do. And so,
yeah.
Out of here, buddy. So there are different kinds of biases and, and different degrees of even within the same bias, there's different degrees of it. And, you know, it is more or less obvious in many cases. So it's not as if the mere fact that we all have biases means we're exempt from exercising judgment.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I read a number of blogs of people who are really doing good work in a third world country, but who are whose decision making is just solely based on their faith, and that I'd like to know what's really going on in the brain and what's really making the decisions, how that decision is being made when they believe that the, you know, that they are being guided by a decision that's being made by God. In other words, God's telling them to do this, God's telling them to do that. It's the will of God that I do this. I'm going to pick up my family and move clear across the country because it's God's will. But then it didn't work out that I pick up my family and move across the country. That didn't work out. So maybe we didn't really listen to God carefully enough. Yeah. I mean, this kind of, what's going on in their heads? How is that decision actually being made?
Well, if we knew how brain decisions were actually made, we would all, you know, have whatever degree is five beyond doctorate. The human brain is the most complicated thing in the known universe. Nobody has really ever been able to successfully explain consciousness, despite the title of Dan Dennett's book, Consciousness Explained. We aren't really quite sure what the hell is going on in there. We do know that the process you describe is a very common one.
Oh, yeah.
As that people will come to some sort of conclusion that seems to make sense to them for reasons that they may not be able to fully articulate. The extreme examples of those are people who contend that they actually did hear the voice of God talking to them. And in fact, there's some part of their brain that is creating what is handed up to the conscious brain as something that sounds like someone speaking to them. There's been experiments with people who've had the corpus callosum severed. It's the membrane that divides the left part of the brain from the right part of the brain. And it turns out that the two halves of the brain are capable of learning independently from each other. So if you have somebody with the corpus callosum severed and you cover up, actually I don't even know that you have to have that. I think if you just take a normal person, cover up their left eye and have them learn new vocabulary words with their right eye, then cover up the right eye and have them learn a different set of vocabulary words with the left eye, and then show them a picture of something that corresponds to one of these vocabulary words, depending on which eye is covered up, they will attach a different word to the object that they see, because the two halves of the brain have learned things differently. And they talk to each other. And sometimes when the left side of the brain is talking to the right side of the brain, it can be interpreted as being a voice from outside the brain, because it's the subconscious part of the left side talking to the conscious part of the right side, or vice versa. And so it's interpreted as being actual voices from outside your head. Even if you don't hear it as an actual voice from outside your head, the process is still going on. And that's what leads to decisions like, let's pull up stakes and move across the country. And if it doesn't work out, there's like a shitload of rationalizations you can come up with for why. You know, all of which can be rationalized, because the human brain is just immensely good at coming up with rational explanations for decisions that were made on a completely irrational basis. And we're really good at doing that.
There's a cartoon where these two kids are up in the attic and they find a Santa Claus suit, and one kid says to the other, I bet the old man shot him and hit his clothes up here.
Well, maybe that's a good point to end on. Thank you very much, Richard.
You bet.
Richard, I'm wondering, is it okay to have faith in the scientific method?
If you think so, Al, go right ahead.